Good morning, listeners. Today is May 3rd, 2017, and we are One BDF Podcast. Today, we have been given the honor of having Dr. Robles, a general surgeon at Middlesex Hospital, and Dr. Kapoor, who specializes in primary care, for an interview. Dr. Robles has been with Middlesex for quite some time. He specializes in a variety of different surgeries, and he's worked with a variety of different people. Dr. Kapoor is part of the group Middlesex Family Physicians. Please give them a warm welcome. So, where did you guys grow up?
You should talk to Dr. Kapoor first.
Yeah. So I grew up in Wallingford, actually. My family moved to Wallingford when I was like 3 years old. So I went to, I don't know if I'm allowed to say that, I went to Moran. I played basketball there, but then I switched sides and I went to Lyman Hall next door for high school. So I'm Wallingford, born and raised.
Not born.
Well, essentially. Born in New Haven. Born in New Haven.
All right, so where did I grow up? I grew up in Bristol, Connecticut, which is a lot like Wallingford. Pretty much similar circumstances. We moved there when I was around three. Before that, my father was also a surgeon, but when I was born, they were living in Montreal, although I was born in Bristol. Then we lived in Boston for a couple years, and then... So I don't remember any of that. So all I remember is Bristol, which is very much like Wallingford. So when I went to public schools, very much like this. So that's where I grew up.
So what did you guys want to be when growing up?
That's a tough question.
It was easy for me, for my father was a general surgeon, so I didn't know better. The only doctors that I knew were my dad and the people on MASH, the television show. Did you guys ever see that? It's about a bunch of doctors during the Korean War, and they just do silly things. So they were all surgeons, predominantly. So the only doctors I knew were surgeons, and then I guess my pediatrician. So I thought all doctors operate on people, but I guess I was wrong. That's pretty much always what I wanted to do, probably just because of my father's influence.
For me, it was, a lot of it was also my father's influence, but that's more the background of growing up with an immigrant father who, you know, had a blue-collar job, very manual labor, and, he wanted something better for his children, and I was the last of three kids. So my brother was into, electronics and computers back when computers were a new age thing, and so he kind of had his own interests. And when I was growing up, I was spoiled because I was the little kid, and I played a lot of sports, and so I just wanted to play sports. That's all I wanted to do. I never really thought about what I wanted to do when I grew up, probably until I got to middle school or high school, somewhere around like 8th or 9th grade, when you kind of got to start thinking about that stuff a little more seriously. And similarly, we had some friends who were doctors, one of which, the most prominent family friend, was a surgeon, a general surgeon in Milford. But I never saw him practice, so I didn't know what he did. So really the only experience I had with doctors was my pediatrician and my family medicine doctor. And so I grew up thinking I wanted to be a pediatrician. And it wasn't until med school that I realized I kind of enjoyed taking care of adults too. And so I broadened that, and now I take care of kids from birth to death. I mean, people from birth to death. So it doesn't really matter what age you are.
How supportive were your parents and others that had a significant role in your life?
Like I said, my father was a general surgeon. My father also was an immigrant. He came from the Philippines. He grew up during World War II in the Philippines, so I think he had a very harsh younger times. And he never really talked about it, and I think because he was so traumatized by it. But eventually he went to medical school at one of the very preeminent schools in the Philippines, and a lot of the people who went to that school, if they wanted to improve their lifelong dreams, they all came to America. So it's kind of unfortunate that some of the best people left the Philippines. But my father came here, Eventually, he met my mother in Waterbury, who was a nursing student. So they were, and my mother eventually worked in an operating room, so they were both very surgical type of people. So they were very influential, and they're obviously very supportive. So supportive that my father said, okay, if you finish this, you can join my practice or have my practice. It wasn't really joining him. So it was always the plan. And there were some, you know, bumps in the road where I took a couple years off. I lived in Nantucket. My father was like, what are you doing? When are you going to get serious? When are you going to do this or that? And are there any Asian people here? No Asian people? Asian parents are pretty intense. Asian fathers especially are pretty intense about, especially their sons. And he was pretty intense with my two other brothers, but I think he knew that I was going to be the surgeon, so I didn't feel too pressured by it. And my mom didn't really care. She said, if you don't want to be a doctor, it doesn't matter. So my mom was the, you know, do what you want. Because she understood how tough it is to be a surgeon, having married one. But yeah, they're very influential, supportive.
I think you find support in different ways from your parents. And similar to Dr. Robles, my dad was, he had an interesting way of being supportive. He was very, he was certainly influential, and in certain respects he was, I don't want to say threatening is not really the right word, but Asian immigrant parents in general can be very, you know, they have these grand dreams for their kids, and they almost kind of force you into what they want you to become. And that was true for my older sister. You know, they had these grand dreams of her becoming a doctor, and that's all they ever talked about, and she went on to become a chemist. And, you know, she's a successful mom. You know, she's a successful chemist. She has a great life, but she never lived up to their dreams for her.
Slacker.
And so it was kind of, you know, in their own way, they're supporting you, but it can be overwhelming, right? And so I think similarly, I think my mom had a kind of a softer side where she didn't really care if you ended up being a doctor, as long as you ended up being a good person, right? And enjoying what you did, having a good life, and, you know, for her, family was more important than the outcome of your career. And so I think if it weren't for my dad really pushing me, I don't know that I necessarily would have gone the exact path that I went, but I mean, I'd like to say that I kind of carved the path myself, though, with the support of my parents, and not only my parents, but I think, you know, my brother, my sister, friends, along the way. I think, you know, your classmates are probably one of the biggest sources of support that you have, because they're going through exactly what you're going through. And so if you're going to cry on someone's shoulders, it's going to be your classmate, not your dad, you know?
Dad's not sympathetic.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And so
You didn't get A's? You didn't get A's and everything?
And so I think growing up, I found a lot of support along the way, but you gotta see where that support's really going to come from when you need it.
What is your favorite childhood memory?
Ooh. How far back in childhood?
Yeah, there's a lot.
Any time of your choosing.
Oh, wow.
Most of mine revolve around sports. oh, geez, there's a lot. The first one that comes to mind, I mean, does it count as childhood if I was older than you guys are? Okay, all right. So I was in high school, and we were playing at Fitzgerald Field at Lyman Hall. It was a night game against Shelton High School. And as it turns out, like 15 years later, I found out that one of my colleagues in residency at Middlesex was on the opposite team. He was playing for Shelton. And we were tied 1-1, and it was my junior year, I think. We were a decent team. Shelton's always a good team. And their best player, who I think later went on to play D1 soccer, he had this breakaway streaking down the left side of the field, and I was the last defender, and he actually beat our goalie and had a wide open shot on the net, and he laid this nice soft shot right on the ground towards the goal, and I came sliding across the slippery field and cleared the ball out, and I slid another like 10 feet into the net, and I got my leg stuck, and the crowd was just going nuts. And then like 2 minutes later, we scored a game-winning goal with like 19 seconds on the clock, and it was like this, you know, like the culmination of everything you dream about in soccer coming true in one game. It was great.
I think a bunch of my childhood memories surround my cousins growing up. We were, on my mother's side, they were Italian immigrants. My grandparents came from Italy. My mother couldn't speak English when she went to grammar school. So I kind of see that side of my experience very much like the Spanish people of our generation coming from Mexico or Guatemala or wherever and not speaking English when you went to kindergarten. Well, that was my mom's family, and the family was very close. So my grandmother lived kind of centrally. We lived two blocks this way. My cousins lived two blocks that way. So we spent a lot of time with them. But my uncle ran the Bristol Boys Club, and he ran the summer camp. So he and my aunt kind of ran it. And my cousins were always there, and my brothers and I would go up there, and we'd have our run at the place because my uncle ran the place. So we had so much fun. I mean, it was just straightforward summer camp stuff, but we just... Because, you know, six of my cousins were all there, we just, you know, there's just countless opportunities of overnights and canoeing and hiking up in, it was Salisbury, Connecticut, kind of the northwest corner. So a lot of my memories surround that.
Did you have any siblings? And if so, how did they impact you?
So we already both talked about, well, you talked about your siblings. I have an older brother and a younger brother. We were pretty close in age. My older brother was only, I think, 20 months older than me. And my younger brother is 2 years younger than me. And in some ways it was good growing up so close. In a lot of ways it wasn't so good because I think everyone felt the pressure of being compared to each other. So my brother, who was a smart guy, who went to Boston College, as I was in high school and all that, I kind of outdid everything that he had done. Not that he really cared, although I think there was some resentment. And unfortunately, my younger brother, who's a very smart guy, was in the shadow of the two of us, and he wanted nothing to be compared with us. Again, very smart guy. And I think, unfortunately, he was a little bored in school. He was a little wayward. But he did well. He has like 3 master's degrees now. He's an acupuncturist. But he was very resentful towards me, probably until he graduated college, and then he realized that I was actually just a regular guy. I think, unfortunately, he was in my shadow. But through school, we were not very close. Probably, I think part of that was being so close in age, being probably somewhat competitive brothers.
For me, my brother and sister are much older than me. My brother is 12 years older than me. My sister's 11 years older than me, and they were both born in India, actually, and so they immigrated here when they were like 3 and 2 years old, respectively. And so, you know, my sister wanted a baby sister, my brother wanted a baby brother, and then I think he grew up to regret that thought. I think, you know, being so much younger, it was almost like being an only child. Felt like I had four sets of eyes always looking after me, which was probably good in some respects and awful in others. But my brother started picking on me when I was when I was like in elementary school and in middle school, and then, you know, my sister was probably my best friend through those periods of time, and, you know, we didn't have a lot of cousins, certainly not cousins my age, didn't have a whole lot of, you know, close Indian families around to grow up with. So it was, you know, me and my Wallingford friends, essentially. And my brother and sister both went off to college at the same time. So when I was later in elementary school, it was just me and my parents for, like, the school year. And my brother and sister would come home during the summer. And it wasn't until probably later in middle school, early high school, where I was able to help my brother out with his, like, hobbies, like fixing up the cars and working on computers and things like that, that he started to actually enjoy having me around. And now we're pretty close.
So the moral of the story is if you don't get along with your siblings now, you probably will eventually.
Exactly. I think it's tough when you're growing up because, you know, your parents are always comparing you. Why can't you be more like Johnny? Why can't you be more like this? You know, look at what this kid did and what that kid did. And it's tough living in that kind of scenario. And once you're growing up, you don't get compared anymore. You know, you're looking for someone to kind of reflect on and say, hey, remember how ridiculous it was when mom and dad made us do this?
Because they're going to have the same life experience, almost the identical life experience that you had, and then you're out in the world and these people that can't identify with you, but your sibling can.
So they'll eventually be some of your best friends, but maybe not when you're growing up.
How did your friends help you reach success?
As Dr. Kapoor was saying, you know, your friends are kind of your contemporaries in terms of where they are in their life as compared to where you are. And I've always had, having gone through all that I've gone through, so essentially from going back in time from what you guys are to what I am now, there's middle school, high school, and there's 4 years of college. I took a little time off there for a couple of years. And then 4 years of medical school, and then 5 years of surgery training, and then I was able to do what I'm doing. So, I mean, that's many, many years. Through that, you're always moving to a different place. So other than, you know, junior high school and high school, that's the same group of friends. You go to college, that's a different group of friends. You spend some time doing something else, another group of friends. You go to medical school, that's a different group of friends. You go to residency, that's a different group of friends. And then when you actually get a job, it's a different group of friends. I always found, like, you kind of always lose track with the people who are way, way back. Right now, I have a friend from high school I was very good friends with who I see maybe once a year. It's not like we talk that often. From college, I don't think I see anyone. I'm not in contact with anyone. Medical school, not a lot of contact. People in residency, where you spend 5 years and we work like 100 hours a week, so these people were pretty much, you know, you lived with them. So one guy who I was very close with is actually Andrew's godfather, so he's such a close friend. So I talk to him all the time, and he's a surgeon also, so he and I have a lot to bitch about to each other and compare. So the more... Probably the last thing that you do, whether you go to grad school or if you go to college or you go to nursing school or whatever, that last thing you do, those people are going to be very similar to you. So that group of friends will probably be the friends you identify with the most. But hopefully you'll have friends from going back through the years. I think my cousins kind of fill that gap for me from the high school or hometown things, because I'm very friendly with my cousins. But that's... You know, that's going back because we're related.
So, I mean, very similar to Dr. Robles' experience. So for me, what I can kind of summarize this with is I'm getting married this summer, so we're putting together a invitation list for the wedding, right? And my fiancée, she grew up in Newtown. She went to high school in Newtown, went to Bucknell, and then did this online master's degree at Emory down in Atlanta for her master's in public health. So she, you know, she's had some experiences in her life. She has some close friends from Newtown, a couple close friends from college, very few from her online program because you see them like 4 times a year and you work on projects together, but it's mostly online. Kind of weird to invite a friend from online to your wedding. So her guest list was very small. And
yours.
I have the double whammy because A, I have way more schooling than her, and B, I'm Indian. So Indian families are typically very large because your cousins are really just, they might be related to you, but they might just be family friends, and you just grew up thinking they were cousins. So, of course, they're invited. Everybody's invited. But then, you know, I grew up in Wallingford. I'm still around here, so I'm still in contact with some friends from high school. And then I went to college. A lot of my college friends actually went into medicine. And, you know, we had a big suite my senior year, and so I was close with my suite mates. So they're invited. And then I had a couple years similarly between college and med school. Went to med school, some friends from there. Residency, I just finished residency, so they're fresh in my mind. So not only are they, you know, my most recent group of friends, but how am I not going to invite them? You know, it's going to be a little reunion of sorts. Cause it'll be 1 year since we graduated. And so my guest list is astronomical compared to hers. But then along the way, you'll find other people that you're, you know, you have something in common with that you get along with. You know, Dr. Robles and I played soccer together. We went to the same undergrad. We are both in medicine. We have, you know, have similar senses of humor. So we hang out.
So the reason we met, I'm the esteemed instructor of surgery at Middlesex, and he was a resident for the last 4 years?
Mm-hmm.
4 years. So he did a rotation with us. I found out that he went to Tufts, and I went to Tufts. So if you go to Tufts, you're like, he's my peeps. And so not only was he learning some of the surgical stuff from me, but we became friends just because we're very, very similar interests. And now we play soccer every Tuesday night because I invite him to join this group of friends and we've been playing for a while. So you tend to find people, and man, you're like half my age or something, aren't you? But that doesn't matter. Once the age difference as you get older obviously means a lot less.
Now let's talk about your experience before your career. What jobs did you have before you were a doctor?
All right, you want to go through all of them? All right. For 3 weeks one summer at age 16, I worked concrete, and that was horrible. That was work, and it was. I think that was one of those things like, okay, go do this for a few weeks so that you don't work concrete the rest of your life. Then I got the cush job in an air-conditioning laboratory at Bristol Hospital. Worked that weekends, actually through college. Worked other jobs at that hospital. And then I worked at a research lab at Tufts. Because back in the day, did you do any research before medical school?
Yeah.
It used to be. I don't know if it still is one of those requirements to get to medical school. You have to do some research. So I did that at Tufts. And then between college and medical school, I did resort work on Nantucket Island. Collected garbage, I cut grass, picked up garbage on the beach. That was fun. And then I did some freelance writing. I did substitute teaching. I taught 8th grade English for a month as a substitute. That was a blast. Because in June of your 8th grade year, trying to get you to read a book. I was that guy, the substitute, trying to make, and I read it. I made those kids read that book. That was fun. And then there was medical school. So once you're in medical school, there's really, you're not working. So then, as a resident, you could call that a job, but I mean, working 100 hours a week is not really a job. That's servitude. And then here I'm a surgeon.
My first job was at, so do you guys remember what checks are? So back in the day, when you deposited a check, it would come back to you in the mail with a little inscription on the bottom. It would be coded. And so there was a company in Wallingford that actually did that coding called Fiserv. And that was my first job. So basically all these bank checks would come up in these locked bags. And my job would be to unlock the bags and put them on little trays for the coders to code. And I got paid like, I think it was $8.80 an hour, which is now below minimum wage, I think.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Back then, it was like,
yeah.
It was like, man, what am I going to spend all this money on?
When I lived in Boston, working that research job in Boston, I got paid $5.50 an hour. And I was like, I ate peanut butter and jelly. And that was it. Like at that job, they had to. It was a nutrition job, and they always needed control in your experience because it was nutrition on elderly people. So they always needed a young person donate his blood to see, okay, what are the levels of this, what are the levels of that, And they're like, okay, we're going to measure lycopene, which is what it's in tomatoes. It's one of these little nutrients. They went to Chinatown, bought like 5 tomatoes, made me eat 5 tomatoes, and then they're drawing my blood all afternoon. But they did my cholesterol that summer, and it was like, it was below normal because it was like peanut butter and jelly and tomatoes. Because, you know, you have to sacrifice to get where you're going to go. And when you're 20 years old or wherever you are, it was fun. It was all fun.
So that was my first job. That was junior and senior year of high school. And then my friend in high school started his own landscaping business. So on the side, I'd help him and, you know, make some money there. And then he also worked at the Villa Capri, which used to be on Route 5 and was recently destroyed, and they're building
it's going to be a Cumbies now, right?
Cumberland
yeah,
Farms there.
Oh, yeah.
So I used to work like evenings on Fridays at, you know, Villa Capri, working weddings. And then I went to college. During college, I'd come home during the summer and I'd work, but I also worked in college. And I was a security guard at one of the gyms there. And then my junior and senior year, I worked as a teaching assistant for the chemistry lab, which was a nice, cozy gig. Yeah.
Really?
I did some chemistry research, PChem, physical chemistry research, which was unpaid.
Pranav chemistry.
Yeah. And then what did I do after that? So after college, I had a couple like summer internships doing research at a company in Brantford, at a pharmaceutical company where my sister worked, which grew me disinterested in chemistry, but I was already kind of already invested in the degree, so I stuck with that. That's when we decided it was medicine or bust. And then after that, I worked through a temp agency doing like computer work for various companies until med school. It's kind of a variety of gigs. Nothing that was really like, aside from the landscaping, nothing that was really like.
Yeah. So one of the themes there is exploit any connection you have to get a job.
Yeah.
So my father helped me get the job at the hospital. My brother's wife got me that job doing the pharmaceutical writing. So, you know, if you have no connection to this job you're applying to, it's going to be hard to get in. So if you have a brother, a cousin,
yeah.
or an aunt. Or
and it doesn't have to be paid. So you can volunteer, right? So when I was in college, I volunteered. So I went to college in just north of Boston. My senior year, I was lucky enough to have a car. So I would drive out west to Newton Wesley Hospital, and I would volunteer there on Saturdays. Just to kind of get my feet into a hospital door, you know.
What were your goals for the future when you embarked on your journey to become a doctor?
Well, just becoming the doctor was kind of... that was... You have to overcome a whole lot of testing and accepting here and there. And even after becoming a doctor, you have to take a set of 3 or 4 exams even before you can become licensed as a doctor. So you guys think, well, you guys haven't even had the SATs yet, but there's a lot of standardized testing, especially to become a doctor. Once you are well into medical school, you got to decide what you want to do. And that's kind of do or die. Once you make that decision, you go into residency, you kind of have to stick with it or you have to start over. And if you start over, it's just going to make your training that much longer. So I committed to 5 years of general surgery. And so you have to pass those 3 exams. We didn't have to land a make-believe. You had to do the physical exam part. So that was 4 parts for the board exam.
They consider that. There are 2. So
you have 3 written.
For med school, you have step 1, which is basically a multiple choice exam. Then there's step 2, which has 2 different parts to it. One is multiple choice, and one is you have a
examining
fake physician. Fake patient that you're examining, and you have to write a like progress notes on the patient and come up with like a plan to in terms of how to take care of this fake patient. And then you have step three, which is another written exam.
So then after you do that, you do your training, and then you have to...
become board certified.
Yeah, you should become board certified. I know it's mandatory, but for board certification for general surgery, you need a written exam and then an oral exam. And then every 10 years, you have to recertify, so there's a lot. So in terms of setting a goal, you kind of make that decision what you want to do once you get into medical school. And that's, I wouldn't say it's a crapshoot. I mean, you got to have a good idea going into medical school what you kind of want to do. And then there's a lot of nuances beyond that, what style of practice you want to do. Do you want to practice by yourself? Do you want to practice with a group of people? There's a lot of, but you figure that out as you go along.
And there's also a lot of, like, non-work-related goals, right? Like, there's always, like, that work-life balance. And so trying to figure out that life part is kind of a continuous challenge. And that's where, you know, during residency, people typically, when you're working, we weren't allowed to work 100 hours a week. We were only allowed to work 80 hours a week, which is still a lot of hours a week over, you know, 4 years or 5 years. And during that time period, it's particularly difficult to find that life balance. And so when this idea of playing soccer came up, I was in, man. Tuesday nights were booked. If I didn't have to be in the hospital, I was playing soccer. Because that was something to kind of get me out, outside of work or outside of school, to kind of let loose and be yourself a little bit, like your non-professional self. And so, you know, that's one of my goals, is to try and maintain that, try and achieve some of that balance and find what's missing in your life.
And even beyond that is, what do you want from your personal life? What do you want from your family? What do you want? You know, do you want a bunch of kids? Do you not want to have any kids? Do you want to be single? Do you want to do this? Do you want that? And a lot of that will impact what you're ultimately going to do. And this is not a sexist statement what I'm going to say now, but historically in my father's generation, everyone in medical school was male. And then everyone out and they worked 80 hours a week. Now, medical school is greater than 50% female. When women go to medical school, they start their career, but midway into their career, they want to have kids and have a family, so then they work 30 hours instead of 80 hours. So they're saying, even though we're graduating more people from medical school right now, there's less work being done. But that's because I have no issue with these women saying, hey, I want to have a family. I think you're a better person. You're going to be a better doctor if you're happier. Mm-hmm. So it's just one of those things that you're going to balance. And it's, you shouldn't look at it as a draw, you know, detriment to your success, having a family and having a...
Yeah, it provides longevity, right? So in any field, be it, you know, medicine, law, if you go into engineering, if you do whatever, it doesn't matter what you do, you're going to be at risk to burn yourself out, right? If you spent all day, every day in the classroom, at some point you'd say, I can't focus anymore, I can't do this, right? You throw your hands up in the air, you walk out, and you're done, right? In the real world, we call that, you know, burnout. people retire early, right? People stop doing what they do well. They stop enjoying what they're doing. And so, you know, from an early age, I think it's important to find, you know, you're along this journey for a long time. You have to, no matter what you're going into, you're in it for the long haul. You got to make sure that you're taking care of yourself along the way, to prevent kind of the burnout.
Okay, so now let's talk more about your careers. What is your favorite and least favorite part of your job?
Favorite and least favorite?
I mean, my favorite part is, man, I mean, there's a lot of things that I enjoy about my work, right? I think getting to take care of patients and change their lives is, I mean, what as a doctor, what better thing can you hope for, right? No matter what field of medicine you go into, I think that's kind of the ideal, the altruistic thing in medicine is to go in and try and heal. There's a lot of... there's a lot that goes into that, and a lot of it, a lot of things in medicine are not really friendly to the provider. You know, documentation, you have to make sure that you document everything. You have to make sure that, you know, it's not enough to just go in, talk to the patient, examine them, you know, prescribe them medicine if they need it, and give them, you know, this advice to go on and improve their life. You have to document everything you said to them. You have to document your physical exam findings. You have to document the risks and benefits of starting this medicine versus not starting this medicine. What are the potential problems that they can encounter down the road?
And you have to document that you discuss smoking cessation with them, even though it has nothing to do with what
exactly.
You're doing. There's all these mandated things that you have to do, which have nothing to do with what you're trying to achieve, which bog you down.
Yeah, so instead of, you know, taking 15 minutes to just purely take care of this patient, write down a brief little thing about what you did, you know, you spent 15 minutes taking care of the patient, and then you spend 8 minutes writing a note about what happened in the exam room. And that 8 minutes over however many patients per day, over however many patients per week, you know, it leads to kind of feeling a little bit burnt at the ends by the end of the day, you know.
Surgery is a little different in that I have a lot of fun every day. Surgery, if you like surgery, if you don't like surgery, you'd be miserable. But it's a very hands-on fix. You're fixing someone. They have a horrible gallbladder. They have colon cancer. They got this. They're draining pus somewhere.
Totally.
You fix it, and then your person's better. And when you do that, you're in an operating room. And the operating room is an interesting situation where that surgery is, a lot of times I say, yeah, it's surgery, it's just a job, whatever. I go to work and I do stuff. But you have an anesthesiologist in the room who's also went to medical school. You probably have an anesthetist who is a graduate level nursing person. You have a full certified nurse who specializes in OR care. Then you have another person who's passing the instruments. Then you have the people in the recovery room. You have people in the pre-op area. So you have all these people taking care of this one person at one time. And I'm the captain of the ship because I'm bringing the person there. I'm doing the thing. Everyone else takes a break. Remember, I'm doing like a 6-hour surgery. I'm the dude. I'm it. I'm in for 6 hours. Everyone else is coming. They're taking breaks and all their stuff. So that's a little bit of the drawback. But it's fun having that group of people, especially if you work with a regular group of people all the time. The patient's asleep. They have no idea what we're talking about. Having fun, and I'm fixing a hernia, I'm taking a gallbladder out. But it is very rewarding because you're working with all these people who have a high level of education and professionalism that I kind of take for granted, but it's very rewarding and it can be very fun.
Yeah, you always talk about how you do like exotic trivia during.
We do exotic trivia. We'll just so when we have a new nursing student in the room or something like that, I'll quiz them on Connecticut state trivia because a lot of them are from Connecticut. I'm like, okay, what's a state bird? State bird? Anyone? You guys didn't pay attention.
Robin, come on,
yes.
That you quiz me about this all the time.
What's the state tree? Anyone know the state tree?
What?
No.
In the white oak.
White oak! Yeah, you know these because you're at my house.
Yeah.
Anyway, so we just get into silly, silly talk. We listen to music and we jam out to stuff. The unpleasant part of my job, because it's surgery, there's times when I have to tell people you're going to die. There's times when I tell people you have cancer that you can't fix. And there's sometimes I'm not even talking to the patient because the patient's about to die. I have to talk to the family. It's like, there's no use in operating on your loved one. I think I do that well, and I can relate to people, but it doesn't mean I like doing that. Someone's got to do it, and I think I do it better than a lot of other people are not in the position to do that. The emergency room doctors, you think, would be better at that. A lot of them are not. They say, well, look, this person has a big hole in their large intestine. They're 88 years old. They're having a heart attack as we speak. And my answer to them on the phone is like, well, then why are you calling me? Because they don't need surgery. I'm like, well, can you come and talk to the family? So I have to go and talk to the family and say, okay, look, if we operate on your loved one, they're probably not going to live. But if they live, they're going to have a colostomy. They're going to have a tracheostomy. They're going to have a ventilator forever. So it's not fun like being in the operating room, but it's one of those necessary parts of the job. The annoyance with all the documentation stuff, I agree, but what I do is a lot less than he does. So my documentation, I do an operation for an hour and a half, I have to dictate a couple notes, do this and that, and then I'm done. Whereas when he sees someone for 15 minutes, he has got another 10 minutes where he has to do all this other crap.
So from a primary care standpoint, having those end-of-life conversations is actually... I don't mind doing that stuff.
He's,
you know,
in primary care, he's developed a relationship with these people for over years and years, yeah, and years. I see people 10
so
minutes.
So it's kind of a role reversal in that aspect, because they really should be having that conversation with not the surgeon, but their regular doc, because that cancer should have been caught before they went to the ER, right? There should have been a plan in place by their family medicine doc or their internal medicine doc or whoever to take better... not better care of them, but to take better care of their symptoms before they show up in the emergency room. And so that's where I feel like I can really change someone's life, right? Not that I can change the fact that they're going to die, but I can change the fact that they're going to live a better quality of life. And that gives me a lot of satisfaction.
Can you describe how your job has affected your lifestyle?
Our personal lifestyles or the lifestyles of our families? Because those are very different. I mean, my lifestyle has been this, right? Ever since college, I was up late. I'd get up early. Maybe not so much in college, but now, certainly. And, you know, you're used to kind of being a light sleeper when you're on call and things like that. But for family members, like, my parents still don't understand what it means when I'm on call. When I was in residency, their only family friend was a surgeon who, you know, when he was on call... he could be at their house, answer the call, and if he needed to go in, sure, he would go in, but he could manage a lot from home. There's different styles of call. And so they didn't understand, well, why do you have to be in the hospital if you're on call? You know, why do you have to stay there overnight? And so it affected my family members more than it affected me, because this is the lifestyle that I've just...
Yeah, I think when you understand, and you better understand what you're getting into, because if you get there and you just... There's two people in medical school who I recall very vividly. In the middle of medical school, they said, "What the heck am I doing here?" And they don't want to take call. They don't want to deal with sick people. They don't want to. But everyone said, "You got to be a doctor. You got to be a doctor. You got to be a doctor." So both those people went into rehab medicine, which is it's called physiatry. It's essentially a doctor level physical therapist. So there's no call for that. People aren't dying on you. They're not coughing on you. But I agree with Dr. Kapoor. You know, your family's got to understand. And yeah, you know, it bothers me when I can't be at one of my kids' things because I'm on call. Or sometimes it's good because I don't want to be at some things. It's, you know, there's a lot of sacrifice, but I don't think it's part of the deal. And every few years you get closer to burnout, and you're like, well, what the heck? And the benefit is you know that you're going to work hard, but as a physician, you get paid decently to do what you do. So, you know, we're able to have a house in Vermont.
That's just a symphony orchestra moving by. That's fine.
So we're able to, all the things that we like to do as a family, ski and do ski weekends and stuff like that, we're able to do because I'm making this money as a physician. I mean, if I work this hard and this many hours and stayed up this late at night and made, you know, what a postman made, there's no way. You know, I'd quit that. Mm-hmm. So... you do take the sacrifice, but you know that there's going to be, there's going to be some money at the end of that.
Our final and most important question is, in your opinion, what does it take to be successful in the 21st century?
I did this. These questions aren't new because I did this with my daughter. Actually, Dr. Kakakis's first year here. There was only four of you around the table when I did it last time, but I guess budget cuts and all that. Success, I think, is it's really subjective. It's kind of up to the person to decide what success is. And success, what I think is success, is going to be totally different from, you know, someone else, some other parent. So what I think success for my Andrew is going to be different from, you know, one of your parents. So I think living to your potential, I mean, if you have potential and you squander it, I think that's kind of a waste. And you could be happy, but part of what you are meant to achieve is kind of your obligation to do that. I mean, that kind of sounds strange, but if you have the gifts and the ability to do something that's gonna be good for society, I think you kind of are obligated to do that. And that could be being a teacher, it could be being a defense lawyer, it could be an engineer, could be a politician. But if you're good at something and it's gonna benefit society, I think that's a success. Some people measure success just by the bottom line and the dollars, and that really turns me off, but I mean, some people are gonna believe that. But I think if you work to your, the ability that's given you to do what you want to do, you enjoy doing it. And there's, you know, a benefit to society. I'm not saying that you're gonna work for .com and it's gonna be the latest Twitter, and maybe that's not that beneficial to society, but I guess you kids in middle school think that's great. But, I think just because we're doctors sitting here doesn't mean that, you know, we're more successful than anyone else who's sitting here.
Yeah, I agree. I think just because you have an advanced degree in whatever it is doesn't necessarily make you a success. Right? I think you can be, you know, a radiologist and be really bad at your job. It doesn't mean that you're a success just because you're sitting in a reading room reading films. I think when I look back at middle school or high school or even elementary school, I remember my favorite teachers, right? I remember the ones that they weren't necessarily everybody's favorite teacher, but for me, I recall them making a difference in my life, and to me, they were successful. Right, they affected me and how I went on to do what I do, and so I think, you know, the definition of success is kind of what you do for society, right? And certain politicians, they get a bad rap, but some of them do really good things for society, and that's kind of, again, right, when you go into a field, you go in with these. Ideally, you go in with the goal of doing what's right, and I hope...
What's right for the most people,
what's right for you. What's ethical, right? And I hope most politicians go into their field hoping to achieve that. I don't know where they get, you know, ruined along the way, but... and I think, you know, similarly, I think, like Facebook, for example... Right. When that came out, I was at Tufts, and it was created at Harvard, which is like 2.5 miles away. And so Tufts was one of the first schools on Facebook. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was hesitant. I didn't really see the benefit of it. And then, you know, finally I signed up. And, you know, I don't know if back then I would have said, hey, Mark Zuckerberg, you're a huge success. Right? Like, you made Facebook. Yeah, big deal. But now if you look at Facebook, like the number of people on it and the way it keeps families in communication with each other and old friends in communication with each other, and, you know, he made a ton of money on it. Is he successful because he made the money? I don't think that's really the case. I think he's successful because he made a difference in people's lives. He's doing good things with the money. He's donating a lot of money back to society. He's helping out school systems in, you know, various areas throughout the U.S. You know, he's being philanthropic with that money. Not because he has to, but because I think that's what's making him even more successful. And so I think Dr. Robles was spot on. I think, you know, if you have potential to do something for the betterment of those around you, that's what's going to make you a better person and a more successful person.
And it's not to say that, you know, more and more and more education is going to do that. If you have natural talent doing something else, be it a musician or a dancer or an artist... in my high school, which was very much like Lyman Hall, I was third in the class. The number one, she went to Yale. I don't even know what she's doing now. Obviously a smart girl. She went to Yale. She's dumb. She's doing fine. Number two, the girl I went to my junior prom with, should have gone to college, and every teacher said, oh, how come you're not going to college? She was a phenomenal dancer. Her brother ran a dance studio. She said, I'm going to New York, I'm going to dance. And all the teachers were like, what are you doing? And she went to New York and she danced, and I'm sure she had a very, you know, successful time there, but she was too short, unfortunately, so she never really got the roles that she wanted. She helps teach her brother's dance studio, and I think she runs a daycare, and she's perfectly happy. And that's, you know, I think that's a measure of success. So even all the teachers are saying, oh, you're not doing this, you're not doing that.
Yeah.
And, you know, then I went to Tufts, became a doctor. The guy behind me went to the Naval Academy, became a pilot. So, you know, she's being compared against us, but it's not really fair to her because I'm sure she's happy. She has a fulfilling life. She runs a daycare and she enjoys it. So I think, you know, the success, and she beat me. She had a better grade point average than I did in high school. You could say she was better than me in a regard. So I think that's important because here we are talking about more and more education, more and more education. If you're a fantastic songwriter, if you're you're the next Ed Sheeran, I don't know, he didn't go to university. Maybe he did. I don't know. But it's not university, which is important to his existence, you know, or Taylor Swift or Miley Cyrus, the little hussy. You know, so you could say they're successful and they're entertaining people, and that's important. If that's what's important to you, I think that's great.
I mean, even going back, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame just inducted, you know, the new class or whatever, and Pearl Jam, which was one of my favorite bands growing up, was inducted to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And I don't know if you guys are familiar with Pearl Jam at all. In the '90s, they were very popular, but not they weren't just popular for their music. They were popular for like social stands that they took and they still take, right? Like, they were, you know, they wanted to be like strong independent musicians who made music for their fans, right? And they were one of the first bands that openly allowed recording at their concerts, and you could put those recordings out. They didn't care, right? They didn't want people having to pay fees for tickets, and they actually sued Ticketmaster in the 1990s, and they lost. But they, like, who is going to sue the person who's selling the tickets to your concert, you know? And then they got sick of the record label, so they didn't have a record label. They were putting out their own album. Like, they did what they thought was right, and they continue to do that. And I don't think any of them went to, I don't know if they graduated from high school, let alone went to college. You know, there's, you know, there's ample room to, I'm not saying don't go to college, right? That's not the purpose of what I'm saying. I think college has a place in many people's
Stay
lives.
Stay in school.
But I think, you know, I think if you have a talent like that, then, I mean,
run with it.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you, Dr. Robles and Dr. Kapoor, for lending us your valuable time and for coming here and being with us today. And as always, thank you to our listeners for tuning in. We are Step 1 BDF Podcast signing off.